Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Chuck story when we come back. Well, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history, and surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion in our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. The federal government, for instance, currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American. Now, that's according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. A little closer to home, your state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on you. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that the state of New York and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems. Those systems contained 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And each and every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, your bank, your insurance company, other businesses and industry obtain all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? Well, knowing how this information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call us here at the law school and ask for our free general law CD package. That number is 417-273-4967. Let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. This program is educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, best of all, it's free of charge. That number again is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our webpage, it's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email when you get there, and then send your email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about checks. I said in the last program, checks are about as common as pig tracks. Everybody's got one. At least normal people have checking accounts. Now, there's a few iconoclasts out there that don't have checking accounts, don't have credit cards, don't practice the fiat paper money system, but there's not very many. Not very many indeed. Now, last time I said, after we took a look at Joe the Barber and that story, and the endorsements on the back of the check, the chosen action, I said we'd start off with the Harry Connick story, and that I would use some stories to kind of illustrate and to explain and make it kind of simple so that everybody can grasp and understand the concepts that we're talking about here when we talk about checks. Checks, something that's so common and something that virtually no one knows anything about. Now, your banker understands checks. You can bet your banker, he knows and understands those checks. It's a guardian ward relationship that you establish with your bank, declaring yourself to be incompetent and unable to manage your financial affairs, and naming the bank as your guardian ad litem to take care of you and your money, because you are fiscally irresponsible. Now, that's the bottom line. That's the legal construction that we put upon people who have checking accounts, social security numbers, and use fiat currency. The average guy that uses fiat currency and checks and credit cards doesn't know that. Nobody explained that to him in school, even though you've probably been institutionalized like I was for many, many years. They don't necessarily explain to you how the real world works just because you've been institutionalized in the public education system. So in the Harry Connick story, it goes something like this. My dad wants to buy a quart of milk and a loaf of bread from Harry Connick, the local grocer down on the corner. Now, he doesn't want to go down to the store himself, so he sends me, little Georgie Gordon, 5 years old, with a note. And on the note, he writes some words, and the words say to the effect, "Dear Harry, please give little Georgie a quart of milk and a loaf of bread, and I'll pay you when I see you." And then he signs it, Daddy Gordon. Now, he calls little Georgie over. He says, "Here, little Georgie, let me give you this note. You take this down to Harry Connick, the corner grocer, and you give him this note, and he'll give you a quart of milk and a loaf of bread, and you bring that home for lunch." And so I take the note, and I go down to the store, and I hand the note up to Harry on the counter. Harry takes it. He looks at the note. He reads it. He says, "Okay, you wait right here, little Georgie." And so he goes and gets the bread and milk, comes back over, And then he takes my note in their hand, and he rings up in the cash register, and then he sticks the note under the drawer in the cash register. It's like a receivable. It's a note. And he gives me the bread and milk, takes me over to the door, and he points to home, and he says, now, he tucks the bag up under my arm, he says, now you go right straight home, little Georgie. I guess Harry must have thought that I was probably going to go home by way of the J Street bus line or something. But anyway, I start going home, and as I'm walking home, between the store and home, a legal question devolves, and that is, at this moment in time, who owns that bread and milk? Who owns the bread and milk? In between the store and in between home. Now, we know who owned the bread and milk before little Georgie walked into the store. That was Harry. And we know who desired to own the bread and milk before we went to the store, and that was Daddy. And we know who's in actual physical possession of the bread and milk, and we've probably been told and we've heard that possession is 9 points of the law, and little Georgie's in possession of the bread and milk. So let's ask ourselves this legal question. Who owns the bread and milk while little Georgie is in transit between the store and home? If you said, well, little Georgie owns the bread and milk because he's in possession of it. Or you could say, Harry owns the bread and milk because he hasn't been paid for it. Or you could say, Daddy owns the bread and milk because he contracted for it. But if you took this case to trial, there isn't a judge in America who would fail to tell you that Daddy Gordon owns the bread and milk, irrespective of who's in possession, and irrespective of whether or not Harry's been paid or will ever be paid. Harry Connick may not be paid, but he's never entitled to his bread and milk back. It sounds shocking. My God, that sounds like that's outrageous and belongs in Reader's Digest. Now, I don't make these laws, and I don't make these principles of laws. I'm just a reporter, remember? So what is it that creates this ownership? Well, at the common law, if this transaction came down, why, Daddy would still own the bread and milk as an operation of law because he contracted for the bread and milk, and Harry agreed to the terms and conditions of the contract. The contract, the proposal, the tender offer, and that's what the note is. It's called a tender offer. Daddy has tendered an offer through his agent, little Georgie, to Harry, the store owner. He said, please, give little Georgie a loaf of bread and a quart of milk. And then he says, I will pay you when I see you. What if Daddy never sees Harry again, forever? One of the terms of the contract is that Harry has to see Daddy in order to get paid. One of the terms is, please give little Georgie a quart of milk and a loaf of bread. Harry did that. Harry gave little Georgie a quart of milk and a loaf of bread. So the ownership transfers to Daddy upon the execution of the contract when Harry said to little Georgie, Daddy's agent, now you go right straight home. Little Georgie doesn't own the bread and milk. He's an agent. Not only that, he's too little. He's too young. He doesn't have capacity. Greyhound Bus Lines has capacity, but they can't own the goods in transit. They're merely an agent. All right, so now we find out that under the Uniform Commercial Code, under the laws of bills and notes, that a note transfers the ownership of the property to somebody who's not in possession and who has not paid for the property in question. He's not in possession, and he hasn't paid for it, and yet he's the owner of it. Now, Harry can sue, or he can be sued, based upon this note. Daddy can sue or be sued based upon this note. In fact, the note is even assignable. It's called a warehouse receipt. Let's suppose that Harry Connick transfers the note to you. You come in and you say, gee, I'm looking for notes, and I've got 35 cents here, and I'd like to buy a note. And Harry says, well, I happen to have a Daddy Gordon note. And here it is. It's 35 cents. He sells it to you. And then you go over to Daddy Gordon and say, geez, I've got this note for 35 cents. I want to present it to you, and I want you to pay me rather than Harry. And Daddy could pay you the 35 cents. You give him the note. He tears the note up. That's the end of the agreement. Contract is fulfilled. And you might say, well, how did I get paid? Well, Harry might have discounted the note to you for 25 cents, and you made a dime for your trouble. We do this in real estate all the time. You know, you can have a note, second deed of trust, or a third deed of trust, and you might discount the note to 70% and sell it to somebody who then makes the 30% by waiting patiently to collect all the payments. Very common practice. Now, let me describe a warehouse receipt to you, because a warehouse receipt is a little bit different than a check. An American Express traveler's check is a warehouse receipt. That's a bill that has been bought and paid for in advance, whereas a check, a check, has not been paid yet. It hasn't been paid yet. So a CHEQUE has been paid up front. That's an American Express traveler's check, CHEQUE, paid for in advance. It's still a check. It's still a right of recovery, a chosen action in interstate commerce. But it's been paid for in advance, whereas a CHECK has not been paid in advance. So one's a warehouse receipt and the other's a check. It's an expectation of being paid at some future date. Now, a check isn't money. The check is not money. It is a claim upon money to be paid, and nobody ever has to deal in any money, per se. We could just deal in checks, bills, notes, credits, and discharges forever. And that's what most Americans do. In fact, I was in a service station not too long ago, and in just casual conversation, I asked the operator, I said, how much of your business is cash? And he said 7%. 7% of his business is cash. 93% is checks and credit cards. Isn't that amazing? So for the 93% of this service station owner's business, he doesn't need money. And indeed, in America today, money is not even used very often. Most transactions in America are made with checks or some other form of commercial paper. It's not made by dealing in any money, whether it's fiat or gold or silver or something else. All right, so now we find an important piece of the puzzle. Let's take a look at another piece of the puzzle. One time I went into the White Front store in Oakland, California, and I bought a dresser. It was $140, five-drawer chest is what it was. And I took it home, and then I put it in my apartment. We were using it for some time, and one day there was a knock on the door. And I went to the door, and the young man there said that he was the Alameda County personal property tax assessor, and that he had come to assess my personal property. And I not understanding, I was a young kid, remember, mentally retarded, just recently released from being institutionalized in the public school system, and I didn't quite understand, and I said, no, you made a mistake. The manager is across the hall. You want to go talk to the manager about property taxes. And then he said to me, is your name George Gordon? And I said, yeah. And he said, no, I've got the right apartment. I'm the personal property tax assessor. Well, being a hillbilly from the sticks, still not understanding what this fellow meant by personal property, he said, I need to come into your apartment. I need to inventory your furniture, clothes, and guns, and things like that, your personal property, so that we can tax it. Well, having been to public school and having read something about our Constitution and Bill of Rights and property and property rights, I thought that was outrageous. So I said to the young man, I said, if you step across, I said, this is my castle. My apartment is my castle. My home is my castle. I'd heard that somewhere. And I said, that's the threshold, pointing down there to the stick that goes under the door, you know. I said, that's the threshold. And I said, if you step across that threshold, there is going to be blood everywhere. And some of that blood is going to be yours, so you better get the hell out of here while you can still walk. And he left. He left. He thought I was probably going to get violent. And had he walked across that threshold, he was right. And I was about to get real violent. Now, I didn't understand the law. And I didn't understand taxes. And I didn't understand checks and property. These were foreign and alien terms, remember, to a mentally retarded young fellow just recently released from the public school system. Institutionalization. Dumb as a box of rocks. But I had heard while I was institutionalized that there was something called rights, property, Bill of Rights. Didn't quite understand Fourth Amendment search warrants and things like that, but I'd heard about them. And I wanted to exercise something there called rights, and he left. Now today I can say I'm really sorry I did that, because the young man was there on behalf of the owner of the dresser to collect rent on the owner's property. Now remember, I said I went to White Front and I paid $140. Paid $140 for that dresser. And then I brought it home, put it in my bedroom, put my clothes in it, and I said, that's my dresser. Now come to find out, that wasn't my dresser, it belonged to somebody else. Now some of you real bright people out there, probably been to college and so on, and can think of in these abstract terms. Let me ask you, who was the owner of the dresser in Georgie Gordon's apartment that he paid $140 for at White Front and brought home? And just mull that one over a little bit. And let me ask you this question. I remember, who owned the bread and milk when little Georgie was on his way home from Harry Connick's store? And we found out Daddy Gordon owned the bread and milk as an operation of law, even though he wasn't in possession of it and hadn't paid for it. All right. Now let's think about this. Let's think about the White Front store, and little Georgie Gordon goes in and buys a dresser with Daddy's notes. I've got Daddy's notes. And who then, as an operation of law, owns the dresser? If you said the Federal Reserve, you're right. The Federal Reserve owns the dresser. Little Georgie Gordon is the Federal Reserve's agent in possession. And the White Front store willingly and voluntarily alienated their right to their property, the dresser, by giving it to Georgie Gordon. Just like Harry Connick voluntarily and willingly alienated his right to the bread and milk by giving it to Georgie Gordon, who in turn was taking it to the issuer of the note So the guy that issues the note under the Uniform Commercial Code becomes the owner of the property, even though he's not in possession of the property and hasn't paid for it. Now, I guess we need to get to the term payment. Because, you know, when you write a check, if I said, did you pay your electric bill? Oh, yes, I paid the electric bill. And if I said, how did you pay the electric bill? Well, I sent him a check. Did you pay the phone bill? Yes. How'd you pay the phone bill? Well, I sent them a check. So when we write a check, we use the word pay. I paid my bill. I paid this or that. Or I paid for this or that. I bought gasoline and I paid for it with my credit card. Paid. When you look up that word pay and payment in the legal dictionary, it's a little different than discharge. You can discharge a debt. That's like bankruptcy. Bankruptcy, we don't say, well, Gordon went through bankruptcy and paid off all of his creditors. We say Gordon went through bankruptcy and discharged all of his creditors. Discharged. Didn't pay them. But after the discharge, you're no longer legally liable to pay those debts. And so there's something different about discharge and payment. And what's different is that you pay your debts with gold and silver coin. You discharge your debts with commercial paper. Now, in 1933, an interesting thing happened. 20 years after the enactment of the Federal Reserve Act, that was back in 1913, and 20 years later, on June 5th, 1933, Congress enacted a House Joint Resolution called House Joint Resolution 192 to suspend the gold standard and abrogate the gold clause. Here's what the resolution declared. It said, whereas the holding or dealing in gold affects the public interest and are therefore subject to proper regulation and restriction, and whereas the existing emergency has disclosed that provisions of obligations which purport to give the obligee a right to require payment in gold or a particular kind of coin or currency are inconsistent with the declared policy of Congress in the payment of debts. This resolution declared that any obligation requiring payment in gold or a particular kind of coin or currency or in an amount in money of the United States measured thereby is declared to be against public policy. Now, if it had been declared in English pounds or French francs, that would have been a different story. But if it's a contract that's declared in dollars of the United States, well, then the Congress comes along and says, well, gold and silver now are no longer, at least gold, not silver, but gold, or a gold clause in the contract is no longer legally enforceable. And they said every obligation heretofore or hereafter incurred shall be discharged, not paid, but discharged upon payment of dollar for dollar in any coin or currency, which at the time of payment is legal tender for public and private debts. Interestingly enough, the words do not talk about payment of debt, but clearly states that every obligation shall be discharged. All right, now in a case called Stanek versus White, cited at 172 Minnesota 390, there's an explanation here. It's in legalese, and it's a little hard to understand, but I'm going to read the legalese, and then I'll give you the plain English translation as to what this thing of payment versus discharge actually means. The court said, there is a distinction between a debt discharged and a debt paid. Period. Okay, so that's easy enough to understand. There's a distinction between a debt discharged and a debt paid. Something's different when you pay a debt and when you discharge a debt. When you go through bankruptcy, you discharge, and when you go into some place and you pay them. When a debt is discharged, the debt still exists, though it's divested of its character as a legal obligation during the operation of the discharge. Do you get that? When you go in and discharge a debt, the debt still exists. The debt isn't paid, it's discharged, so it continues to exist. Huh, isn't that peculiar? Something of the original vitality of the debt continues to exist, which may be transferred, even though the transferee takes it subject to its disability, incident to that discharge. The fact that the debt, carries something which may be a consideration for a new promise to pay, so as to make an otherwise worthless promise, a legal obligation, makes it the subject of transfer by assignment. Now, that comes from a case called Stanek versus White. Now, if I were to read that to you in plain English, when I get over here to the plain English section of Stanek versus White here, let's see if I can find that for you. We'll find that when you discharge a debt, the debt continues to exist. I discharged my debt at White Front with $20 bills from the Federal Reserve, but something of the original vitality of the debt continued to exist because I hadn't paid, even though White Front was happy with what they received for their dresser. So, in plainer English, there's a clear distinction between a debt that is discharged and a debt that's been paid. When a debt is discharged, it is not extinguished. The debt continues to exist. So, when a debt is discharged, it changes its character. A debt paid is extinguished. A debt paid is terminated. It's absolved. It's wiped out. It ceases to exist. But when a debt is discharged, it continues to exist. Now, a discharge then transfers the debt to the next person, like the old maid in a card game. And the person who accepts this discharge, accepts this old maid, agrees that there is a disability that he accepts as a condition of the discharge. So that the disability that he accepts is the loss of his property and the loss of his property right in both the money and the product or service. He accepts this disability voluntarily in exchange for the profit that he makes on the transaction. So Harry Connick was happy to give up the bread and milk for the profit that he was going to make on the transaction. He didn't make 35 cents on the transaction because he probably paid 20 cents for the goods, but he was going to make 15 cents profit. So he said, yeah, I'm going to give the bread and milk so that I can get 35 cents. I paid out 20, I'll get 35 cents back, so I'll make a 15 cent profit. So I will give up my ownership claim to the bread and milk. It's a commercial transaction. It comes under the Commerce Clause at Article 1, Section 8 of our federal constitution. Commerce. Now, commerce is something different than property and property rights. And the first plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for the abolition of, or the abrogation of, all right to property. Property is the holy grail of law. Property is the holy grail of the common law. Property and property rights, ownership of property, is the holy grail in Anglo-Saxon administration. But under communism, the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, under our national economy, under House Joint Resolution 192, we give up our rights to property for the benefits that we receive in commercial paper for the production of profit and gain, for which we pay an income tax, by the way. So the income tax is on profit and gain that you make from the unjust weights and balances which violate the common law provision in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36, and Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16. Isn't that just real special? Now let's go back to Joe the barber. Remember old Joe? Joe the barber took a check from Sam the banker. Now, Sam the banker collected a full $9 worth of services off of Joe the barber. Do you remember that? And then Sam the banker left and went to Chicago. Joe the barber passed the check on to Bill the supplier, who passed it on to Charlie the grocer, who passed it on to Sally the beautician, and so on, 30 times in the community. That $9 check primed the pump, stimulated the local economy of Des Moines, Iowa, and it sent $270 worth of trade, commerce, business, and industry coursing through the local economy of Des Moines. $9 check created $270 worth of trade, commerce, business, and industry. And then old George Gordon comes along, takes the check, gives Barney's Beanery a book, goes down to the bank to cash the check, and the check won't clear. So George Gordon, ornery sucker that he is really upset and wants to sue somebody, and a question arises as to should he sue Barney's Beanery, which at the common law is the correct party, to collect his $9, because when Barney signed the check as an endorsee, he endorsed the check, and he says, in effect, a merchant's word is as good as gold, and if there's anything wrong with this check, I will pay it all. Well, so did Rob the Roofer. He said, a merchant's word is as good as gold, and if there's anything wrong with this check, I'll pay it all. Don's Diner said, a merchant's word is as good as gold, and if anything goes wrong with this check, I'll pay it all. We've got to take a little break here, so let me explain when we come back. Joint and several liability. Joint and several liability as it relates to the check and the endorsement when we come back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, and please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call The Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about The Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call The Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I said we'd take a look here at joint and several liability. Let me tell you another little story here. We had a student come here one time and We went through our tax and status school, and we were explaining this concept of checks, and we got to joint and several liability, and I went through that little story, and he was really surprised about joint and several liability. He said, well, does that work also when you're a member of a church? And I said, you bet it does. This joint and several liability applies to you when you join the National Rifle Association or the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts or any other group or organization. I call it the groupies. And he was really surprised at the concept of joint and several liability. And so as a Seventh-day Adventist from Tulsa, Oklahoma, he went back to Tulsa to his local church, and he went up to the deacon and he said, I would like to have a copy of this church's charter so that I can see what my legal liabilities are as it relates to joint and several liability. Well, the deacon, not understanding this request, asked him, why did he want it? He said, I want to know what I'm liable for. Well, the deacon assured him that you're not liable for anything. You're just a lay member. And furthermore, since you're not a deacon and you're not an official in the church, you're not entitled to this corporate charter. I'll bet you that that deacon didn't even know what a corporate charter was, where it's recorded, what it said, or where to get a copy. But he assured this parishioner that he had no liability whatsoever, and that this was a business matter between the church and its officials and its contracting parties. It had nothing to do with the parishioners. That's the guy sitting in the pews and paying all the bills, you know, with their offerings and tithes. Well, the deacon's dead wrong. I don't think he understands the law, but then deacons don't become deacons because they're lawyers. So he went to the preacher, and he asked the preacher, and the preacher assured him that, well, of course there's no liability. See, you're not a contracting member. You're not on the board of directors. You're not a deacon or a preacher or a minister. You don't have any liability. You haven't signed any agreements. Lay people in the church, he was assured, have no liabilities whatsoever. And he persisted, and he said, but I want a copy. I want to read the church articles of incorporation. And he was told in no uncertain terms that it was none of his business, and the answer was no, he could not get that. Now, I want to point out to you that a corporate charter is not private, it's public business. It's recorded with your state's Secretary of State. Every corporation in Oklahoma is recorded in the Secretary of State's office, and it's public information that anybody can get. You just go to the Secretary of State and say, I would like to have the corporate charter of Walmart. I would like to have the corporate charter of General Electric. And if it's recorded in that state, there's a fee you have to pay. And I remember in those days it was $5. You paid the Secretary of State $5, and he would go photocopy that charter and give it to you. So when he called me and told me that they had threatened him with excommunication, I said, well, that's not surprising. He told me this story, and I responded. I said, well, it would be my guess that the minister probably doesn't understand what he's talking about. The deacon, he doesn't know. And I said, you're going to have to go over to, this is many years ago, this is before we had emails and online services. I said, you're going to have to go over to Oklahoma City and go into the Secretary of State's office. He's in the Capitol building. And then tell him you want the corporate charter for the Seventh-day Adventist Church of Tulsa, Oklahoma. He did, and he got the charter, took it home, and you're ready. He called me a few days later, and he said, I'm absolutely aghast at the terms and conditions that are contained in this charter. And I said, well, what is it? And he said, well, what you said about joint and several liability is true. It's in the charter, paragraph 18. And the joint and several liability has to do with the church's debt. Now, he confided to me. He said, this church owes about $200,000, the building fund, $200,000, to a local bank, and that there are about 200 members in the church. That's about $1,000 for each member. And each member of the church has joint and several liability. Now, I don't think that the deacon, just looking back on, I don't think that the deacon and the preacher lied to this fellow intentionally, trying to deceive him. I, honest to God, don't think that they knew or understood what a corporate charter was, how it works, why it works that way, or what joint and several liability is all about. And so they were probably telling him the truth, and they from their point of view, they said, well, now when we have a board meeting, when we have minutes of the board meeting, we don't make that public to the parishioners that go to church here. We take their money, we deposit their money in the bank, their offerings and their tithes. We pay the building fund, we buy the songbooks, we pay the telephone bill here at the church and the power bill to keep the air conditioning on in the summer and the heat on in the winter. That doesn't have anything to do with the parishioners. Until he got to paragraph 18, which said in part that the debt of the church was to be held jointly and severally with each and every member of the church. Now, if you've ever joined a church, you'll notice that after you attend for a couple of 3 weeks, some nice man called the deacon comes over, has a little card, hands it to you, and says, we like you, and we would like you to become a member of our church. Would you like membership? Would you like us to accept you as a member? And now, being flattered and all, gosh, they like me. Everybody likes to be liked, and so, oh, they like me, and they want me to be a member. I can join the church. I can join the club. I've been invited in. I've qualified. And so you fill out the card, you know, your name, address, and phone number, and you give it to the deacon. He puts you on the rolls and says, here's a member. Now, joint and several liability works like this. Let's suppose that this church, for the sake of our discussion here, doesn't make their payments. The 200 parishioners, they don't put enough money in the offering plate, and they don't pay enough money in their tithes to pay the monthly mortgage installment on the church building. Does the bank come in and foreclose on the church, like the bank comes in and forecloses on your house, and then take the church and then sell it to the highest bidder? When was the last time you saw a church sold on the courthouse steps? No, sir, that's bad public relations. And banks know that. And banks do not lend money to institutions and organizations based upon whether or not that institution has the wherewithal to pay, but rather the deep pockets members. So they look at the membership and they say, well, oh, look at this. Here's George Gordon, and let's say he's a lawyer, and he's a member of your church. And, oh, look at this. Here's Dr. Goodwin Jones, and look at this. Here's another doctor, and here's a dentist, and here's a chiropractor. And so the bank says, yes, based upon the membership of your church, these deep pocket members of your church, the pillars in your community, we will lend you the $200,000 or $500,000 to build this new church. It's based upon the membership. Now, let's suppose the church misses their payments, and they've missed three or four payments. And maybe these payments amount to, a few thousand bucks, and the outstanding balance is $200,000. And let's suppose that in the mortgage contract, there's an acceleration clause that says that if you miss a payment, it makes the entire note due and payable. And now the whole $200,000 is due and payable. So the bank, without any notice to Dr. Goodwin Knight, just lifts $200,000 right out of his account at the bank. Not just the church's bank, any bank. Any FDIC insured bank. They just lift it right out of there. Now, here's Dr. Knight. He wakes up one Monday morning, and his account's been raided for $200,000. He runs down to the bank, and he says, you've taken $200,000 out of my account. And the banker says, yes, sir. Yes, sir, we did, as per your instructions, sir. And Dr. Knight says, but I didn't give you any instructions. Oh, yes, yes, you did. You did, Dr. Knight. You see, you joined the Seventh-day Adventist Church of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And under the corporate charter, paragraph 18, you accepted joint and several liability for the debts of the church. And the church failed to make its payments. And because the church failed to make its payments, we here at the bank took the $200,000 as per your instructions in paragraph 18 of the corporate charter and your membership agreement with the church and took the whole $200,000 out of your account. Thank you, Dr. Knight. Now, some of you may be sitting there saying, oh, my God, that can't happen in America. Oh, yeah, happens in America every day. That's called an adhesion contract. Adhesion. An adhesion contract is a contract in which you don't know what the terms and conditions of the agreement are, but you have signed up. You have agreed to the terms and conditions. We have your signed agreement, even though you didn't know. This is a fraud. There's nothing fraudulent about this. There was nothing fraudulent when the deacon came up to you and said, would you like to join the church? You said yes. He handed you a card. You filled it out. He wasn't holding a gun to your head when you filled out the membership card. Yeah, but he didn't tell me that there was joint and several liability. Excuse me. Aren't you educated? Don't you have letters after your name? Didn't you go to college? Didn't you go to high school? Aren't you literate? Don't you read and write? Didn't you learn the Dewey Decimal System? Don't you know how to look information up in a dictionary or an encyclopedia? Oh, you walk into court with some kind of a lame-brained argument that, well, I wasn't informed and I didn't know. Aren't you a sovereign citizen? Aren't you a voter? Educated? And now you're going to say, but I was ignorant and I didn't know? Now, fortunately, Dr. Knight has recourse. You see, it wouldn't be fair. It wouldn't be equitable for Dr. Knight, who's just one member out of 200. Remember, the other 199 members, they all signed membership agreements, and they all agreed that they would pay the whole $200,000 if that became necessary. They also agreed to joint and several liability, didn't they? So Dr. Knight now sues the other 199 members after having made diligent attempts to collect the money personally by making demand upon the other 199. Maybe he stands up in church and says, okay, the church failed to make its payments, the acceleration clause in the mortgage was triggered, and they took the whole amount of money out of my account. Now the bill's been paid, now we own the church. So now you people here have to pay me $199,000. I owe my $1,000, and the other 199 of you all owe your $1,000. Line up over here to the left, walk to the right, and then drop your $1,000 right into my hat over here. Now, the members of the church, assuming that they're all fair-minded people, would line up to the left, move to the right, and drop their $1,000 into your hat and pay you that their fair share. Now, let's suppose that they don't. Somebody gives you a bunch of static, and then you have to collect. You know, you've got to go sue them. And you take this case to court. You see, each and every one of these people are co-signers. And that's what you have with a check. You see, each person who endorses the back of a check becomes a co-signer on the check, right along with Sam the banker. So when Sam the banker wrote the check originally to Joe the barber, Joe the barber endorsed the back of the check and said, I'm an endorsee, I'm a merchant, and a merchant's word is as good as gold, because only merchants deal in checks. Free men deal in gold. Merchants deal in checks and commercial paper. A merchant's word is as good as gold. This check isn't gold, but it's as good as, because my word is good. And so when he endorses or signs, he seals his agreement, his bargain. And the bargain, the agreement, the seal, is predicated upon Title 31, Title 12, and the banking regulations of your state, which none of you people have ever read, don't know anything about. You know less about Title 31 and Title 12 of the U.S. Code as it relates to banks and banking and currency and the money policy of the United States than you do about your church, or at least about the same amount. But you have joint and several liability right along with the bank. You've agreed, even though you've never been informed as to what these terms and conditions are. And boy, are you going to be surprised when you read Title 31 or Title 12. Ooh, boy, are those chapters just filled with neat surprises for people that write checks. So Joe the barber then passes the check on to Bill the supplier. Well, Bill the supplier endorses the back of the check, and he too agrees to these terms and conditions. Isn't that just special? And then Charlie the grocer, he agrees to these terms and conditions, and it goes on down the line over here, and these are called underwriters in the insurance game, underwriters. And here's the way underwriting works. An underwriter. Somebody wants to ship a shipload of oil from Saudi Arabia to England on the Torrey Canyon. And there's about $100 million worth of potential liability involved in the shipment, as was proved out when the Torrey Canyon hit the rocks there in South England. And so Lloyd's of London contracts with the shipper and says, if this ship runs on the rocks, we will pay all of the damages. Loss of oil, loss of the ship, you know, any loss of birds and wildlife and habitat and so on. So sure enough, the ship sets sail, and the Lloyd's of London people, they get a little nervous, and they say, well, gee, if that ship hits the rocks, we'll have to pay out a whole $100 million, and we only got $10 million worth of premiums. But they know that only one ship in 1,000 ever hits the rocks, and so they collect $10 million 1,000 times. And in one time, they got to pay out $100 million. Now, if you want to spread the risk, what you do is you go to another insurance company, and you say, look, would you like to buy half of this premium? I'll give you $5 million and you take $50 million worth of liability. We might divide it up 10 ways. We might go to 10 insurance companies, or 9 other insurance companies in this case, making a total of 10, and each one of them puts up $1 million and then takes $10 million worth of liability. So the premium is 10% and the liability is 100%. The Torrey Canyon hits the rocks, $100 million worth of liability is incurred. And then we find out that Lloyd's of London doesn't have $10 million. In fact, let's suppose that of all of the insurance companies, you're the only insurance company that has $100 million. None of the rest of them even have $10 million. None of the rest of them can pay on the contract. Does that mean then that you pay your $10 million and the other 9 insurance companies pay nothing, and the shipper over here gets paid $10 million instead of $100 million? He has to pay $90 million out of his own pocket because his insurance companies failed him? Oh, no, not at all. You see, when the underwriter, under joint and several liability, takes $1 million in premiums and offers to take 10% of the losses, he assumes that the other 9 members in the joint venture will be able to pay their $10 million each. But if for some reason any one or more of them cannot pay, then that one insurance company that only received $1 million gets to pay the whole $100 million. Now, you know, these insurance schemes sound real good, but you know, sometimes there are contract liabilities imposed either by government or under the terms and conditions of the law, whether it's the Roman civil law or the common law, which interpret those events. And it's important then that you know and understand the terms and conditions of all of the contracts that you engage in. So before you join a church, you might want to read the corporate charter. Before you open a checking account, maybe you should take a look at Title 31 and Title 12 and find out whether or not you really want to participate in that program. You know, you could read those terms and conditions and come to the conclusion that maybe this isn't for me. All right, now, in reviewing, we find that when Joe the barber contracts with Sam the banker, it's a 4-party limited general partnership between Joe the barber, Sam the banker, the Union National Bank, and the Federal Reserve System. So every time you write a check, it's a 4-party limited general partnership. Well, the bank and the Federal Reserve are represented by Title 31 and Title 12 of the U.S. Code, plus whatever applicable statutes your state may have applied. So when you open the checking account, you too become subject to Title 31, Title 12, and your local banking regulations in your state. Irrespective of whether you've ever read them, have been informed that they exist, know about them, care about them, or don't care about them, it's irrelevant. You're still liable. And they may take your house, may take your car, may lien your bank account, or they may lien your salary or your paycheck. Somebody may. Now, this transaction actually generated a lot of trade, commerce, business, and industry, though, for the local community. Remember last time I told you, this $9 circulating through the community 30 times equals $270 worth of trade, commerce, business, and industry. This is the boom part of the cycle in the money expansion that we go through in the boom portion before we get to the bust. And there's a boom, and then there's a bust, and there's a boom, then there's a bust. It's the way our economy works. It's the way it has always worked. It's the way it works today. And now we're approaching the bust cycle. We've been through the boom cycle from 2000 to 2006 or 7, and now we see that there is a gradual slowdown. We see that there is a continual accumulation of debt, and now we're watching the federal budget deficits along with the balance of payments deficits. And then we're the underwriters. The taxpayers of America are the underwriters for all of that debt. And when that debt becomes due and the United States government can't pay it, the creditors will then come to the taxpayers of America, the underwriters, the insurance underwriters of America, the American taxpayers, just like they did with the savings and loan bailout. Do you remember that back in the Bush administration in 1991? We'll do the same thing with the bust cycle that's coming up under the current Bush administration. All right, next time we'll take a look at this thing of the Harry Connick story and the Circle K story, and we'll combine those two, and we'll show you what happens when you take the check in, cashed at law, without recourse. Next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. So let me remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Well, our time is up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everyone, and good night, friends.